This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. We're up to 60 now, or nearly 60. I think it's like 58, something like that. Nearly 60 female Democratic lawmakers sent a letter to the House Oversight Committee asking for an official congressional investigation into sexual assault allegations against Donald Trump. 60 members of Congress. While this is from a piece on Common Dreams by Jessica Corbett, a staff writer there, she writes, while the lawmakers acknowledge Trump should be allowed to present evidence in his own defense, they also note how, quote, the president's own remarks appear to back up the allegations, even though he has called all his accusers liars. Pretty amazing. And then, you know, the whole Kirsten Gillibrand thing, this is outrageous. Lois Frankel of Florida, Brenda Lawrence of Michigan, and Jackie Speer of California are holding a press conference today on this issue. We'll see if it gets covered. And, you know, Elizabeth Warren's stepping into the fray. But Donald Trump, this isn't ecstatic posts over a Democratic underground. This is not business as usual. His foul tweet was the definition of sexual harassment, saying that Kirsten Gillibrand came to his office and was willing to do anything in exchange for campaign contributions. And I absolutely agree. We shouldn't just move on to the next scandal as if this one didn't just happen. This is a big deal. Donald Trump at 5 o'clock this morning, 5:03 a.m. Who wakes up at 5:03 a.m. to angrily tweet? This is nuts. And then you know, saying these things, I mean, it's just, it is remarkable. Meanwhile, we've got organizations all across the internet who are working to preserve net neutrality in the United States. Please contact your members of Congress. Call the House, call the Senate, contact your members of Congress now and ask them to congressionally assert net neutrality. See, the FCC can have net neutrality as they did, you know, they ensconced it, encoded it, you know, built it into law or into regulation, actually, under Title II, the common carrier provision of the FCC rules. So the FCC can make net neutrality, the FCC can take away net neutrality, but Congress can override anything the FCC does. So if Ajit Pai, the former Verizon lawyer, goes ahead and day after tomorrow tries to hand, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars in revenue, future revenue, to the ISP corporations who were once his boss, and I would argue are still his boss. I mean, the guy is using, you know, phonied up so-called scientific research to prove that his net neutrality destruction isn't actually going to destroy net neutrality. It is a lie. And this is so-called research that is coming from groups that are funded by the internet service providers, by these giant behemoths. We are in full-blown oligarchy territory here in the United States right now. And that's something we should be taking very, very seriously. We should be concerned about this. Interesting piece in medicalexpress.com. If I can just go geeky science on you for a minute. The headline, Major Cause of Dementia Discovered. This was published yesterday. And they were looking at, this is from the University of Manchester in the UK, Professor Garth Cooper looked at what was causing dementia. And they were looking at two ends of the spectrum, Alzheimer's and Huntington's disease, both neurodegenerative diseases that end up producing dementia, but seem to do it. Huntington's seems to have a much larger genetic component. Alzheimer's seems to have a much larger environmental component. We're not really sure what it is. But he started looking at, this was a group of scientists, the University of Manchester, University of Auckland, New Zealand, Ag Research New Zealand, the South Australian Research and Development Institute, Massachusetts General Hospital, Mass General, and Harvard University. And they're looking at what causes dementia. And one of the what they found was that the precursor to dementia, the thing that they can reliably find over a period of months or years before people experience dementia, is high levels of urea in the blood. Now, urea is produced in response. It's the stuff that produces, I believe, urea is the stuff that produces the characteristic appearance and smell of urine. And it is the byproduct, the breakdown byproduct of protein, particularly animal protein. You eat a lot of animal protein, you get high levels of urea in your bloodstream. And this study revealing that urea is similarly linked to Alzheimer's shows, according to Professor Cooper, that the discovery could be relevant to all types of age-related dementias. The Huntington study also showed that the high urea levels occurred before dementia sets in, which could help doctors one day diagnose and even treat dementia well in advance of its onset. Urea and ammonia in the brain are metabolic breakdown products of protein. Urea is more commonly known as a compound which is excreted through the body in urine. If urea and if they build up, then the kidneys can't eliminate them, then you've got a real big problem. But this is what Professor Cooper said. He said, "The study is the final piece of the jigsaw, which leads us to conclude that high brain urea plays a pivotal role in dementia." He says, "Alzheimer's and Huntington's are at opposite ends of the dementia spectrum. So if this holds true for these types, then I believe it's highly likely it'll hold true for all the major age-related dementias." Now, they're not making the leap that I'm making. The team used human brains donated by families for medical research as well as transgenics sheep in Australia for this research. Cutting-edge gas chromatography and mass spectrometry and all kinds of stuff to measure brain urea levels. And he said it has to go up four times higher than normal in the normal brain. So whether this is a failure of the body to excrete urea or whether this is an excess of urea as a consequence of people eating very high protein diets, keep in mind, most Aboriginal and Indigenous people, when you look at their diets, regardless of where they are in the world, about 14 to 17% of their diet, if my recollection is correct, it's been a few years since I read this science, but it's in that neighborhood, it's well under 20% of their diet, is meat or dairy products and things associated with animal products. And about 80, 85% of their diet is vegetable matter. So, you know, many Americans are getting as many as half their calories from meat, you know, eating burgers and whatnot. And so you wonder, is this the thing that's causing dementia? I don't know. But I think a plant-based diet, in addition to preventing heart disease, a friend of mine, I was speaking with on the phone on Saturday. He's 75 years old. 2 years ago, he was told he had a widowmaker in his artery feeding his heart, and that if he didn't have either a stent or open heart surgery, he'd be dead in a year and a half. So he went on a complete vegan diet, eliminated all animal products, all dairy products. And I've had dinner or lunch with my friend Earl probably, you know, two, three dozen times in the couple of years since he got that diagnosis. And he is so rigorous, you know, so rigorous about his diet. And he told me last week he had a stress test and a complete, the EKG, the running on the treadmill, the whole thing. And he is clean as a whistle, right? He no longer has heart disease. You can reverse heart disease by going on a totally plant-based diet. So, anyhow, a little bit of science to break up the insanity, the general insanity of the day. But, you know, I know y'all want to get back to politics. We will do that right after this break. It's coming up on 15 minutes past the hour on the Tom Hartman Program. Back with more of the news of the day and your calls right after this.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Stick around. Your thoughts on what Roy Moore or Doug Jones winning will mean for the future of this country. And welcome back. Let's see here. Steve in Blacksburg, Virginia. Hey, Steve, what's on your mind? Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Your show is so informative. My God, you are my intellectual relief for the afternoon.
Well, thank you, Steve.
Right after 12 o'clock, Donald Trump just signed a bill today for the military. You know, giving away a couple hundred billion more dollars to the Pentagon, I reckon.
Oh, my.
But the whole time he was standing there, Mike Pence was just standing right behind him, just staring at him. And it's like, I never saw his lips move. He's the best ventriloquist in the world.
So, interesting. Is there
Jeff Dunham look like an amateur.
Yeah. Is there a hole in the back of his sports coat for Mike Pence to put his hand in there to move Trump's lips?
Well, I think he might do it with mind control. He might be one of those lizard people.
There you go. It's entirely possible, Steve. It's entirely possible. Okay, a good one. Thank you for the moment of levity, Steve. Nice to hear from you. Bob in Tahlequah, Oklahoma. Hey, Bob, what's on your mind?
Oh, mercy sakes alive, Tom. It's a great time to be alive. I wonder how long we'll be alive. In relation to the internet, I think it's a two-edged sword. It's a lot of high-tech stuff. It leads the world into disarray. There was studies done back in the 70s that clearly pointed out that eating dead hog flesh had no nutritional value whatsoever. This medical research done at Cornell University, and also at China did studies in the 70s that clearly indicated that other than eating a bunch of meat and drinking alcohol, the one other thing that caused cancer predominantly was air pollution.
Yeah.
So these are things that have been known for a long time, and I won't get into the cannabis issue, but if we're going to make this right, we've got to do it from the ground up. It's not going to be done from satellites. Satellites can be helpful, but as long as this high-tech industry-related disaster on the face of this planet goes on with people like Trump, bigots and backward-minded people, there's just, as long as there's excuses for these people being in power, there won't be any change for the better. And we've got to do this from the ground up. Yeah. We're not going to change them until they realize that there's more of us than them. And we are changing things.
Yeah, you're singing my song, Bob. And my point apropos of that is that we have to get inside the Democratic Party and have our voices heard.
I disagree. I think we have to do this and be heard with or without the Democratic Party. I'm registered to vote. I take part in the system. I write letters.
Well, you're right. You can be a political activist outside of the Democratic Party. But what I'm telling you, Bob, I'm all in favor of all the outside groups. You know, I promote them all the time. You know, Move to Amend, Progressive Democrats of America, etc. But that said, really, the laws are made by elected politicians. And the politicians get to where they are via the mechanism of the two political parties. So if you really want to have an influence on the fate and future of this country, get inside the political parties and have some say. We'll be back. Back, Tom Hartman here with you. And Rudy in Atlanta, your thoughts on a Moore victory or a Jones victory?
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
I'm well. How are you, Rudy?
I'm fine. Hey, you know, I often call you and I say, hey, you know, white America's going, you know, they have a crossroads. Well, this is one of them.
Yep.
This is one of those cultural changes that if this guy wins, Roy Moore, you can't walk this one back. This one will be etched in stone as one of those things that Roy Moore speaks to the rock.
Well, just the fact that he's gotten as far as he has and that the president of the United States is out there saying vote for him, that's something you can't undo either, Rudy. I think that they've taken the mask off.
Yeah, but see.
Or the hood.
But I'm just saying this is one of those pivotal points in our in time.
I agree.
And culturally, I honestly believe that the white male will suffer behind this because of the movements are happening, the things that are happening, the undercurrents, the conversations amongst other minority of people, the world. I mean, it's so many people, so many things wrapped up into what this guy represents. The nastiness, and this, I honestly, because when you really look at it, you have to look at the future of what this means to this country. I was just thinking about what Bob was saying, and Bob is saying that culturally we have to take this country back. We have to do something culturally right, because this right here speaks to rot. I mean, just this rot.
Yeah.
And it's nothing good about what this guy potentially can mean to this country.
I think the big issue here, Rudy, is are we looking at the death of white male patriarchy in the United States, or are we simply looking at another incremental change, a change in the right direction? The arc is long, but it bends in the direction of justice.
And Tom, when we spoke before, we was talking about the cancer of what's happening, of hatred and bigotry, all of these things. Now it's beginning to be identified. We're at this particular point to where, you know, we can start to do small things to change. We have to start having these uncomfortable conversations about what's really happening in this country. And if we don't, this is when it's really going to start affecting, the future, the millennials, because we have the opportunity to correct these things now.
Yeah.
But 20 years from now, when you start reaping the fruits of what we should have done, you understand what I'm saying?
I absolutely do, Rudy. And I would argue that in that context. And there's a certain layer of subtlety here that, this could be taken out of context and I could really get my butt kicked for saying this, but I'm going to say it anyway. I think that there is a certain amount of blessing to all of us in the Trump presidency and in the Roy Moore candidacy.
I totally agree.
White people can no longer deny that white supremacy is real. It's a problem, that it's in our faces. I mean, it's all right there. It's like they took the hood off, you know?
The beauty of what you just said about get your butt kicked, because we all have to carry our own cross of things that we know are just wrong.
Yeah.
This guy is wrong.
Yeah. Yeah. He's wrong. He's toxic. He's poisonous to democracy. Yeah. Both Roy Moore and Donald Trump. And, like I said, I think it's waking up a hell of a lot. I know it's waking up an entire generation, the millennial generation, or a large chunk of the millennial generation. And that's
I didn't mean to interrupt, but how can a Christian man of any moral compass, and let's just take religion out of it. I have two daughters and a granddaughter. And to imagine someone, you know, a 14-year-old kid.
Yeah, it's
and Tom. But
I'm sorry, Rudy. Finish.
This, you know what? I have a lot of white male friends. I mean, but you know, it really doesn't matter. I mean, this is nasty. This can potentially just destroy a lot of things in Alabama. I have a lot of friends out there, but it's bad for business, too. It's just bad. It's just rotten.
But it goes way beyond sex, Rudy. I mean, the sex part is salacious. The sex part is what, you know, hits the front pages because it's sex. Sex sells. Everybody loves, you know, salacious stuff. But the reality is that Roy Moore is saying that Muslims should not be allowed to participate in American society, that women should not be allowed to vote in the United States. Yeah. I mean, you know, this is beyond just a guy who is a pervert. This is a guy who is representing the values of the, quote, old South, which are not American values.
Exactly.
And that is what needs to change. Rudy, thank you so much for the call. Very, very well said. As always, good talking with you. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-808-9925.
Back with more of your calls, the news of the day, and my thoughts on all of the above right after this. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Elizabeth in Albuquerque, New Mexico. I think you want to respond to the earlier male caller who said, why don't these women just report their sexual assaults to the police?
Exactly. Yes. I just wanted to talk about a personal situation I had many years ago. I had been in a situation where it was an attempted rape. I'm a pretty feisty person, so I basically knocked him on his ass, but I had to take off, and I had left my car several miles away, and it was the middle of the night. So I'm walking back towards my car, and I saw a police car come by, and I hailed him, and they stopped, and I explained what had happened, and that my car was like, 3 miles away and all. And they basically looked at me and said, well, it's your own fault, and drove away.
Wow.
So, yeah, I mean, this is what happens all the time.
Was it like a variation on you shouldn't have worn that dress, or you shouldn't have been out late at night alone? I mean, is that essentially
exactly
the message?
Exactly. Yeah, wow. That kind of thing. And, it's part of our culture that has been there for so long. It's so embedded.
Right.
I do agree absolutely that we as women do need to be more assertive. I tend to be that way. But, it's really dispiriting when you come across this kind of an attitude day after day after day. I remember my own father saying to me, well, you're way too sensitive. It's just...
Right, and the implicit
we face.
Yeah, and the implication of all that, it's not even subtle, but the implication of all that is basically that men's sex drives are continuously out of control, and that's normal, and that women are the property of men. I mean, when I hear men saying, even to attack Roy Moore, I have daughters and granddaughters. It sounds proprietary, It sounds like, they're my property, and I'm concerned about them. We should be concerned about all people here, and this is a fine thing. And I don't want to super parse this, but I think that your point is really, really well made, Elizabeth. Go ahead.
Absolutely. Well, and to your point, if you think about it, this is what women face when they're in a country where the Taliban rules or ISIS.
Yes.
It's the same attitude, and we better think about that.
Yeah. Amen. Yeah. Well, and that's coming out of religious fundamentalism, and I would say that Roy Moore is coming out of religious fundamentalism.
Absolutely.
And these people call themselves Christians, and they are not followers of Christ. They don't even practice what Christ taught. They are, whether it's the megachurch people who are big supporters of the Republicans, or whether it's Roy Moore and friends. These people are not Christian. They are not followers of Christ. They can call themselves anything they damn well want, but they are not. And anyway, I'm blithering here. Elizabeth, thank you for the call.
No, that's okay. I'm right with you.
Okay, very well said. Thank you very much. I got to move along. Thank you, Tim in Reno, Nevada. Hey, Tim, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I've listened to you a long time. Two things. I would just love nothing better than to hear you and Norman Goldman talk the issues of the day. I listen to both of you, and you're both great. Seriously.
Thank you.
My second point is both you and he and listeners to both your shows have said something along the lines that we don't have civic education in our schools anymore.
Right.
I'm wondering how you come to this, conclusion with heavy quotation marks around it. I taught government history for 28 years, and I'm just curious about that comment. I thought I taught it well, but I just want to hear you reiterate why you think there's no civics education, you and Norman.
Sure. When I was a kid in the 1950s, in third, fourth, fifth grade, we took classes in civics and also in junior high school. In fact, we had to memorize the preamble to the Constitution and the Gettysburg Address. We had to learn, you know, the three branches of government, all this kind of stuff, the stuff that you were teaching. And it was broadly accepted across the United States. There was no federal mandate for it or anything like that, but it was just broadly understood in the 1950s and 1960s that without a good, solid education that comprehensively informed us how our government worked and the philosophy behind it, the philosophy of the Enlightenment, what was John Locke talking about that Jefferson plagiarized for the Declaration of Independence, for example? Without that understanding, we can't have a functioning democracy. And our schools were relatively, our class sizes were reasonable, schools were good, at least in white neighborhoods, which was my experience. I realize that this is, things have changed a lot in a lot of ways. And in the 1950s, there were a lot of people of color who didn't even have access to schools. And in the 1960s as well. I mean, look at what happened in Virginia. But that said, during the Reagan era, when Bill Bennett became the director of the Education Department, after calling for the abolition of SAME, the willingness of the federal government to cut back on any kind of support to education and to basically encourage the process whereby schools are almost exclusively funded by property taxes or largely funded by property taxes really set in stone the rigid caste system in the United States that has to do with primary education, which is to say, if you live in an upscale neighborhood with high property taxes because they have high property values, your kids are going to go to a good school where they probably are going to study civics and they are going to learn about government. On the other hand, if you live in a community that has a low tax base and therefore poor public schools, odds are your kids are not going to be studying that. It's considered basically, and since the 80s, it has been more or less been considered an elective in many states. And then you look at how, starting during the Reagan years, major efforts down in Texas, which is the largest purchaser of textbooks in the United States and therefore is the tail that wags the dog of the textbook publishing companies. They were demanding, now this was in the 80s, there were small changes, but as recently as 10 years ago on this program, we did a whole show about this. We had, I had people on from, a person who was running for the Texas School Board. Or whatever the agency is that makes those decisions, talking about how they had ordered the textbook publishers to dial back on Thomas Jefferson, John Locke, George Washington, all that stuff, because those are all, dead people, and increase the amount of information that's being told about Rush Limbaugh and the rise of the conservative movement in the 1950s and 60s in the United States and the Reagan presidency in the 80s. This was in the early 2000s. And so, our textbooks are being rewritten, essentially, to contain this information. The textbooks now even go so far, and I realize this isn't, specific to the conversation that you and I are having about civics, but now we've got textbooks, actual public school textbooks that are being used that present climate change as a debate and that present the age of the Earth as a debate. This is nuts. That's my rant, Tim.
I was just wondering, that pretty much explains it. I understand, I'm not just trying to butter you up. I understand what you just said. There's real information there, seriously. But I implicit, at least tell me if I'm wrong, implicit in what you're saying is you don't trust us teachers to be in there doing the grunt work and actually resisting this.
No, that's not my point. That's not my point at all, Tim.
Textbooks is, part of what drove me, to retire kind of early at only age 56 in 2010.
Yeah.
But I'm wondering,
Tim, please, that's not my point.
Do you trust us to carry on the battle?
I do. I teachers are one of the greatest resources we have in the United States. They are underpaid and overworked and over in most places and frankly overburdened again because of this stupid property tax system that is a way of making sure that communities, particularly communities of color, have a harder time lifting themselves out of poverty than very wealthy, largely white communities. But the forces that are working to reduce the teaching of science and government and civics, those forces are very, very clear. These are political forces that are being motivated by religious fanatics and by the fossil fuel industry, almost exclusively. And they are you know, there and present, and they are pushing their agenda. They're pushing their agenda in the form of the textbooks. And we now have this thing of Scientology. I don't know if you saw this, but this is from the Huffington Post yesterday. Inside the voucher schools that teach L. Ron Hubbard but say they're not Scientologists, Bessie DeVos wants to expand school voucher programs throughout the U.S. Get ready for that list to include schools that promote Scientology. Turns out there's 8,000 schools in the United States right now, virtually all of them private schools, many of them for-profit schools, many of them not-for-profit, but nonetheless these private schools that are teaching L. Ron Hubbard. And this is the stuff that Betsy DeVos is promoting. We have, you know, this is not an issue of teachers, Tim. This is an issue of structural stuff that is doing tremendous damage to the United States, to our school systems, to our students, and frankly, to our political culture. It's very, very troubling, in my opinion. Tim, I got to run, but thank you for the call. We'll be right back. It's coming up on 15 minutes before the hour. In about 5 minutes, we'll be checking in with Luke Vargas from Talk Media News. Stick around.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Back with more of your calls and Free Speech TV and Talk Media News right after this. And welcome back. Very interesting. I've got to remember to mention this in a minute too. But after I went through that whole rant about how meat might be a cause of dementia or eating too much meat, Louise texted me. You know, Donald Trump eats McDonald's all day long. Bingo. Anyhow, John in Minneapolis. Hey, John, what's on your mind?
Yeah, I guess it kind of concerns me that, you know, people don't want to hear a critique of the Democratic Party. I think we need to critique the Democratic Party, and I don't see that as a circular firing squad. So I guess I was wondering if you could explain to me how that damages the party, because I'm still a Democrat. Whether somebody critiques it or not, I feel like, you know, criticism is a good thing, you know, unless you're talking about public relations. And I don't feel that your program is a public relations program. So maybe you can explain to me, you know, how it is that we're damaging the party if we're critical of the party, especially if it's good criticism.
Are you talking about the woman who called in yesterday and kept coming back to repeating the point that all the Democrats are corrupt and sold out, and they're all taking money just like the Republicans, and they're all the same? And I ultimately cut her off and said no.
I didn't hear that. I didn't hear that program. I was traveling, okay, and so I wasn't able to listen.
Well, John, I'm at the top of the list of people who are critical.
We don't want
corporate Democrats.
Circular firing squad that we can't, you know, criticize. And I think Bernie Sanders, his whole campaign was a critique of the Democratic Party. And it's always, you know, people who critique and then act on that and try to change things, I call that progressivism, you know, are the ones that breathe life into the party, don't you think?
I do. I'm not sure why you think we disagree, John.
Well, you know, I kind of feel like there's a tone that, you know, when you say, I don't want to hear criticism of the Democratic Party, even if it's somewhat strident, you know, I mean...
I've never said that.
It puts a...
Or I'm not... I am not saying... I might have said that, but I'm not saying...
And then somebody is afraid maybe to, you know, call into the program. I think you're usually pretty open to all kinds of opinions, and I hope that you continue with that.
John, there is a funded effort underway to get the message out that the Democrats and the Republicans are the same thing. And much of it is funded by wealthy Republican donors. I've been in the middle of this. In fact, Larry King and I co-sponsored a debate between Jill Stein and Gary, what was his name, the Libertarian, Gary Johnson, the Libertarian candidate, back, you know, like 5-6 years ago in Chicago. And I discovered after the fact that the whole debate, and the essence of the debate was how terrible the Democrats and the Republicans are, that the whole debate had been funded by, or a large chunk of it had been funded in part by a libertarian billionaire and in part by a Republican.
Right. And
you know, as much as the Republican Party is like 5% popularity right now in the United States, the Democratic Party is around half. And the more that the Republicans can promote the idea that the Democrats are just as corrupt as the Democrat, as the Republicans, the more they win. And so there are people who call into this program, and our software keeps pretty much good track of who called and what they said, that's their shtick, is to simply call up, and they are not Democrats, and they don't give a rat's ass about the Democratic Party. They're just trying to promote those Republican talking points. John, thanks for the call. I got to run. Welcome back. Let's check in with Talk Media News and find out what's going on in the world today. This report brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com and Ellen Ratner's new book, Loving What You Do. On the line with us, Talk Media News Services Senior Foreign Correspondent Luke Vargas. Luke, what's on your mind today? What's going on in the world today?
The first thing I think we're looking at here at the United Nations is in a briefing we're going to get just in a few hours from Jeffrey Feltman, who is a former American diplomat, who is now the top political officer at the United Nations, who just got back from a visit to North Korea. And he met with the foreign minister of North Korea in Pyongyang, as well as several other sort of significant figures under Kim Jong-un. So that is something we're going to look forward to. And there has been some speculation, though the White House and the UN have both denied it, that in addition to serving in sort of a United Nations capacity, that this may have been, Mr. Feltman may have been used as some sort of messenger as a way of conveying information from the U.S. government, or even at the very least from the United Nations to the North Korean leadership.
Very interesting.
In a way that you could only do if you actually get to the country. So that's something we're looking forward
to. There's two reports relevant or relating to North Korea that I saw this morning that I would love to hear your take on. One was a piece in the New York Times arguing that the detention camps that Kim is running in North Korea to silence his political enemies are as bad as Auschwitz, that they are as bad as what happened in Nazi Germany in the late 30s, early 40s, number one. And number two, that there's a completely separate story in another, I think it was in the Washington Post, that there appears to be, according to satellite photos, a whole bunch of very frantic activity happening in one of the places where the North Koreans typically test nuclear weapons. And so they may be preparing to shoot off a nuclear bomb. Thoughts on either one of those?
Yeah, and I'll throw in a third, which are reports coming out of both the Financial Times and the New York Times that China has authorized the rapid construction of 5 refugee camps on its side of the North Korean border, which, if correct, could suggest that they are preparing for some sort of major contingency here, in which case they would be prepared for a major refugee influx over that border, which kind of makes sense. It would be surprising if they weren't thinking in contingency plans like that. But again, the level of activity seems to have picked up there. I mean, let me just take the first one very briefly, because I don't know all that much about the activity at the test site. But yes, I mean, this has been a strategy that the United States and others have been trying to increase focus on. And the U.S. now has held, I think this year, 2 or 3 U.N. Security Council meetings just on the human rights situation in North Korea. They feel like that's sort of fertile territory. It's an issue that when the public and people from all over, not just the United States, but the world, hear more and more about the human rights situation in North Korea, that's sort of an untapped area that we sort of have maxed out the ability to get countries to sanction and get their publics to condemn North Korea just on their destabilizing nuclear or missile behavior. But if more were known about human rights situations there, that's fertile territory. And I will point out this trial that's ongoing in Malaysia for the two women who poisoned Kim Jong-nam, sort of brother of Kim Jong-un, that has also suggested to a number of folks who watch North Korea closely that in addition to the sort of labor camps that we know North Korea runs, that they probably have pretty disturbing and extensive medical testing divisions in which they are basically trying out of various forms of these VX, you know, various sort of gases and gels and stuff that they use in these chemical attacks on political prisoners. So suffice it to say, there's a lot there, and I think we are seeing a concerted effort by the U.S. and its allies to talk up the human rights abuses occurring in North Korea.
Right. Okay. What else is going on?
Well, I'll point out we're just learning now from the European Union trade representative that the EU believes it can close a new free trade deal with Mercosur, which is the five countries in South America, Argentina, Brazil, Uruguay, and Paraguay, and Venezuela, that they're currently sort of on suspension right now. And I think this is not a huge story insofar as it impacts the U.S. bottom line. I mean, these countries represent about 2-3% of U.S. trade. But it does show, again, that the sort of global free trade conversation is occurring everywhere outside of the United States. This is a deal that the EU and Mercosur have been working on for something like 17 years, and the discussions have been really fraught. The fact is they've really accelerated in recent months, and the fact that we're nearing completion of that deal shows that they are taking the issue of these new free trade agreements very seriously. Add on to that the fact that on Friday, the European Union and Japan finalized their new FTA, which is comparable in size to NAFTA. And again, you start to see the momentum slipping away here. And I think the Mercosur deal is sort of a missed opportunity for the United States. We'd seen some momentum at the end of the Obama administration to actually try and open up free trade talks with these South American countries. And there was a political opening. I mean, you had a more conservative leader, Macri, in Argentina, a change of leadership in Brazil. The Venezuelans were suspended, so their vote wouldn't count. Bolivia hasn't quite joined in. So it seemed to be a ripe opportunity for the U.S. to build on this political opening and start to move our free trade talks beyond the Pacific and down into South America. It looks like the EU has stolen away that momentum, and it would be quite historic if they're able to wrap up an agreement with Mercosur. It looks like they will early next year.
Right. Remarkable stuff. And then Macron in climate change in France. Hot stuff going on there.
He's trying to take over the mantle of global climate leadership, and he invited 50 heads of state to Paris today for climate talks. The United States was not even invited. The big headline coming out of this meeting is that the World Bank has announced it will no longer fund upstream oil and gas, which basically means exploration and production of crude oil and natural gas. That's a major swing in global investment, and one that, again, Macron seems to be rightfully taking credit for here. I'll point out he also awarded 18 climate research grants from the French government, and 13 of the winners were American. And this is part of what Macron has called his Make the Climate Great Again initiative. So he literally is directly responding to President Trump's announced decision to pull the U.S. out of the Paris Agreement and is trying to take over that mantle on his own. And judging by the number of countries, the number of business leaders there, the investment promises that are being announced from that summit, including that World Bank statement, it appears like French efforts, even just on their own, are able to do quite a lot. But the UN and France are still worried about the progress on some emissions targets. But at least for financing, it appears the drop in U.S. contributions has been more than made up by other countries, which is sort of a silver lining here.
Yeah, remarkable stuff. Luke Vargas with Talk Media News Service. Thank you, Luke.
Thank you, Tom. Talk to you soon.
Great talking with you. Thank you. We'll be back with more right after this.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.